The views expressed on this program are the views of the individual broadcaster and do not necessarily reflect the view of Wesleyan University or the WESU management. Hello, and welcome to Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, a progressive-minded radio show about faith and action, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, and WESUFM.org, providing community radio that matters, and rebroadcast on the University of Connecticut's WHUS 91.7 FM stores and WHUS.org, UConn's radio for the people. I'm Maria Johnson. Today, hooray for Hollywood! Kinda, sorta. It's our annual Oscar Roundup with Commonweal magazine film critic Richard Oliva, who brings not only his predictions, but thoughts on the films that, for various reasons we'll speculate about, didn't get nominated, although they deserve to. We'll be back in a moment with Richard.
Many dogs and cats spend endless days indoors staring at the wall, living for the moment when you will come home and tell them you love them, take them out, and make a fuss over them. Dogs and cats need physical exercise and mental stimulation, things to do and think about in order to be healthy and happy. Please set time aside for them and give them a real life and real love. For more information, please contact People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals at 757-622-PETA or helpinganimals.com. That's helpinganimals.com.
Welcome, Richard Oliva.
Hello, Maria. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. We're here today for our annual Oscar Roundup. And maybe we should, as I like to say, put the news in the lead, talk about the problem with the Oscars.
Well, the problem, as everybody's been discussing lately, is the fact that there are almost no black nominees in any categories for the Academy Awards. Certainly none of the major nominees are black. And it's a great deal of blame has come down on the Academy members as if they were supposed to vote for black contestants. But it seems to me the problem is quite different. A person going into filling out a form and voting for one person or another isn't thinking in terms of race. They're just trying to fulfill the demands of each category, what gave the best performance. And they can't vote with the idea of, I am now going to send a black nominee into this category. The real problem with race is that there are not enough movies being made with leading parts for good black actors and black actresses, and not enough good movies made by good black directors and black writers who perhaps would write about and direct movies about black African-American issues, or perhaps not. Perhaps they would just present whatever their personal concerns were on screen and would win awards for making good movies. In other words, the blame doesn't really rest on each Academy member. It rests with the heads of studios who give the green lights for major productions featuring or not featuring, in this case, not featuring black actors, not written by good black writers, not directed by good black directors, and so forth.
Were there really no good movies with black actors this year?
There were a couple of them. And I think this gets into another topic, a corresponding topic, in that the Academy members look for some film with some sort of cultural pretensions to vote for. And in this case, the fine performance of the year by a black actor would be Michael Jordan's performance in the latest Rocky movie called Creed, in which he plays the son of Apollo Creed. He's really the lead in the movie. Sylvester Stallone is a supporting player.
Wait a minute. Michael Jordan, the basketball player?
Jordan, the actor.
I don't know.
From Fruitvale Station, much honored movie of a couple of years ago, and a great performance by this new young actor, Michael Jordan. I think it's his middle, he uses his middle initial, Michael B. Jordan.
Okay.
I think I got that right.
All right.
But anyway, I just call him Michael Jordan, and here he is playing an athlete, and I hope people don't confuse him with the basketball player. He is a remarkable talent. He gave a great performance in Fruitvale Station, and now he gives a great performance as Apollo Creed's son, also called Creed, who is coached by Rocky Balboa, which makes this the latest and maybe the last of the Rocky movies, and he's tremendous in it. Directed by a black director who made Fruitvale Station.
So why do you think it was overlooked?
I think it was overlooked, and this is why I bring up the topic of pretensions on the part of the Academy members. They're thinking, oh, it's just another Rocky movie, just another piece of schlock. And of course, if they've seen it, it's not a piece of schlock. It's a really carefully done and moving film that uses the exact same formula of the very first Rocky movie, but gets new life into the formula.
Interesting.
With Sylvester Stallone, and I love the comment by the critic David Edelstein in New York Magazine. He said, in the first Rocky movie, Rocky Balboa was just this little man that you saw running through the streets of Philadelphia and training in a broken-down gym, and he made you root for him because he was this little man trying to get his time in the sun. And then he became the legendary Rocky Balboa, and the movies got more and more ridiculous. And now in this latest movie, Rocky Balboa is once again a little man in Philadelphia trying to coach his boxer into a championship fight. And once again, the Rocky formula from the first movie works. A little man making good. Not winning any sort of great victory, but just going the distance and proving something to himself, just like in the first Rocky movie. And I have to say, I didn't expect to be moved by this again. I thought, oh my gosh, this is just going to be a formula. And it was a formula film, but it was a moving formula film. Oh. And Michael Jordan's performance was the one to vote for. But you can't reproach each individual member of the Academy for not voting for Michael Jordan when they favored something else, like Leonardo DiCaprio in The Revenant, or one of the other nominees, Bryan Cranston for Trumbo, or, you know, it's their right to vote for what they feel
is
the best
performance. But you point out that they're being snobbish.
Yeah. There's this feeling, general feeling, and you can't level the charge at each individual member. It's just that there's this general feeling that these are the Academy Awards. They're important. They have to go to an important movie. And Creed didn't fulfill that. It's the same reason they wouldn't give this new Star Wars movie a nomination for Best Picture. It's just another Star Wars movie.
Wow.
Although it makes an incredible amount of money. It's just a formulaic film. And it really is a formulaic film, but done with great panache and great sense of tempo and movement, and it's an entertaining 2.5 hours to spend in the theater. But it is just the old Star Wars, the original Star Wars plot redone for a new generation.
Yeah.
And again, the Academy wouldn't honor that with a nomination. That's less serious a problem, though, than not honoring a good
actor.
It had
a black star, didn't it?
Yes, a young black actor in the cast has the same sort of role of Luke Skywalker. There's a little twist at the end of the movie that I won't reveal, but that gives this new Star Wars movie a kind of feminist slant.
Okay.
It doesn't make the new Star Wars movie important in the sense that an Academy member wants it to be.
This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, providing community radio that matters, and WHUS, 91.7 FM, Storrs, Yukon's radio for the people.
So, I'm a dog, and I just got adopted by this new human guy, and I'm starting to wonder how he got along without me. I mean, okay, something as simple as walking around the block. He's got this leash thing, and he puts me on one end and him on the other, and I'm just taking him around. I think he's afraid of getting lost. Without that leash and me guiding him along, I don't think he'd find his way back home. But it's kind of cute.
A person is the best thing to happen to a shelter pet. Be that person. Adopt. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org.
The movie that's going to win is The Revenant, a movie that has...
You pronounce it so Frenchly.
The Revenant. Well, it is. It's supposed to... It has kind of a French slant to it in
that
some of the Indians in it, some of the Indians have come into contact with both French and English and American settlers. But that's not an important part of the movie.
I'll just say I've successfully resisted seeing this movie because I've seen the trailers and I knew immediately, no,
too
this one's not for me. So you say it's going to win a lot of the...
It's going to win the main awards. It's going to win Best Picture, perhaps Best Actor, although I'm doubtful about that for Leonardo DiCaprio. I have a feeling it's not his year. It's going to win Best Director. It's going to win for Emmanuel Lubezki, the cinematographer, Best Cinematography of the Year. I mean, that's a lock.
Because it's so gorgeous.
It's gorgeous, and it's very real in its photography. It makes you feel the sting of the snow slanting down in Arctic winds. It makes you feel the freezing that the various characters feel in the movie. It makes you feel more completely than any other film has done before the harshness of the climate in the Louisiana Territory in winter. I don't know exactly what state it's supposed to take place in. It's part of the Louisiana Purchase, probably a northern part, in the dead of winter. But unfortunately, although it's magnificent in that regard, that's its main quality, the realism and the beauty of the photography. It's a movie with spiritual pretensions too, and that will help it gain the
How
best
so?
Picture. It's a revenge story. In fact, the novel from which it's drawn is called A Novel of Revenge, The Revenant, A Novel of Revenge. It's based on a true story. A man has been attacked by a bear. He's part of an expedition, a fur hunting expedition. He's given up for dead by the two men assigned to watch over him. He arises from the makeshift grave that they put him in and tracks them down to get revenge for having abandoned him to death. It's a true story. I think in the original, I should have looked this up, but I think in the original account, the original true story, the man did track them down. He did not take his revenge. In the movie made from it back in the 1970 or 71, Man in the Wilderness, starring Richard Harris, he grows so spiritually by watching the depredation suffered by the American Indians that when he tracks down the expedition that abandoned him, he fails to take his. He deliberately refrains from revenge. And in that movie, Man in the Wilderness, which was an uneven movie, a little flat-footed, not amazing photography or direction the way the new movie has. It nevertheless brought across that point that the man has learned how to love life so viscerally that he refuses to take human life, even though he's entitled to a revenge. In this new movie, The Revenant, there's an effort on the part of the director-writer to... Iritu, the Mexican director.
Yeah.
He who made Birdman last year.
Which you loved.
Which I loved. In this movie, he's trying to signal that the man is growing spiritually so that he will refrain from revenge at the last moment. Now, in this new fictionalized version, The Revenant, Leonardo DiCaprio plays a character who not only is left for dead, but sees his own son slaughtered by one of the two who abandoned him. So he really has a reason for revenge. So during the course of his trek, when he arises from his improvised grave and treks across the wilderness trying to track his victimizers down, you feel he really is entitled to revenge. And it's going to take a lot on the part of the script to convince you that he should refrain from revenge.
Yeah.
Well, what does the script do?
Wait. Spoiler alert.
No spoiler alert.
Oh, okay.
This is in the course of the movie. You hear a lot of mutterings by Indians on the soundtrack, his dead Indian wife talking to him in her native language. You can't understand a word of it. He watches American Indians go on the warpath against the white settlers. He comes into contact with a very compassionate, philosophic Indian who says his own family was wiped out by another Indian tribe, but that he will refrain from revenge because revenge is in God's hands. You hear all this, and you figure, oh, Leonardo DiCaprio is given a spiritual education, and that will make him refrain from revenge. Now, I won't reveal the ending, but I'll just say it's one of the most compromised, unconvincing, have-it-both-ways ending a major movie has ever stuck on as a denouement. It's a completely phony, unconvincing ending, and so dishonest that it poisons, at least it poisoned my enjoyment of the rest of the movie.
Well, how come it's going to take so many awards?
Because it has these pretensions. Because people are sympathetic to the plight of the Native American. Because they wanted a hero who spiritually grows and who shows sympathy towards American Indians. It's got all those seemingly compassionate, philosophic.
It checks a lot of boxes.
It checks a lot of boxes, and it seems deserving of award. Of course, the real reason is that for most of the way, it is a cracking good adventure story that cleaned up at the box office more than any other movie this year, except for Star Wars. And what the Academy wants most of all is a movie with artistry and good box office. So when you get that combination, then you hand the award to that picture. But this movie really fails artistically.
You know, it always bothers me when, not that you pointed out, but the fact that money plays a role in, I mean, it's kind of the way we wish politics didn't have any money in it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like these movies should be shown first to the Academy members before they even hit the public screens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
Mm. Yeah.
Just
well, I think, now it's been rumored that the Academy members are aging so fast that they stay at home and the Academy does is send out what you call screeners to the Academy members.
Okay.
Critics get these too. They're just DVDs that are sent to your home before they're released on the market.
Oh.
And so they view all as much as possible at home. But that's many of Academy members are so contemptuous of their assignment that they hand their votes over to other people who aren't even members of the Academy.
Wait, what?
Yeah, this is what I've heard. This is just what I've heard.
What bothers them about having to be a voter in the...
I have no idea, but maybe it's just past disappointments. Maybe Jack Nicholson, I understand, just hands over his ballots to, I don't know, the milkman.
Wow.
People who park his cars, people who give him tickets to basketball games. So who is actually voting? It's actually impossible to say. You'd have to track down the destination of each vote.
Oh.
But there's kind of a mass thinking going on in this. And I wish each member of the Academy would hang on to his or her ballot and just vote their hearts, you know.
Yeah.
And if they did, and if maybe more of them had seen a movie called Youth.
I was just going to say.
Which cleaned up at the Cannes Film Festival this year. It got Best Picture of the Year, Best Actor, Michael Caine, Best Director, Paolo Sorrentino, the three major awards.
And it won your heart.
It won my heart. It's a masterpiece. And when it came time for the Academy Awards, it was utterly ignored in every single category except Best Song.
Best Song. Wow. Well, talk about Youth. What's it about? I saw it, and I would love to hear, and I've read your review, but I would nonetheless love our listeners to hear your synopsis of it. It's because I think it's a hard movie to sum up.
It's not a movie that announces its theme right away. You have to think about it for the theme to emerge and maybe see the movie more than once,
I
did.
Yeah, I said, I got to see this again. Yeah.
And yet it's the only movie with any spiritual quality to it.
And why would you say that? Well, first, say what it's about.
Well, Youth is about youth, and it's not youth. The title is the title of the movie, but it's not youth as we normally view it. It's not an age group. It's not people from age 0 to 30. Youth, instead, in this movie, is the spark of life. It's what the philosopher Henri Bergson talked about. It's what George Bernard Shaw talked about when they talked about the life force. What's what Dylan Thomas talks about when he says the force in the flowers, in plants. The green fuse is what fuses my life. It's the spark of life itself. It has as its heroes an American film director, Mick, played by Harvey Keitel, and his friend, an orchestra conductor, Fred, played by Michael Caine. They're old artists. Mick, the American director, wants to make another movie that sums up his career. The orchestra conductor and composer, Fred, has given up completely. He wants to put his life behind him. He wants to put his work behind him. He has given up on the spark of life. Well, you figure you will watch Mick's struggles, and maybe Fred, the conductor, composer, will somehow renew his energy, or something will happen. Well, what happens, I won't give everything away, but the movie shows how fragile the life force is. How, if you don't respond to the events of your life properly, you may lose the life force. And yet the life force can come back to you in the oddest ways, even if you're trying to pay tribute to a lost friend. In regret, in sorrow, you can find the life force.
Oh,
you can pay some
beautiful
tribute to some dear friend that has died recently. While if you chase the life force in too egotistical a manner, trying to make, as Mick does, a movie that sums up his career, in summing up your career, you may box yourself in. You may see the whole corpus of your work as something that's fixed and dead and past, and you may not be able to add to it because you already regard yourself as an institution, and therefore you're unable to create anything new. I'll just explain one scene. Mick is on a hillside, having been blocked in his latest effort. He sees all the heroines of all his past movies in the costumes of the movies they were in. They're all on the hillside speaking the lines of their roles.
Yeah.
And as he looks at it, there is the great body of his work. But by regarding it this way, he has made himself into something of the past. He has made himself into an institution, a director who's finished, who has accomplished his work, and now he's unable to go on to anything new. Just the opposite transpires with Fred. And I won't give away the ending.
Yeah.
But that's what the movie is about.
Gosh, I get it so much better now. Even after I read your review, and yet hearing you speak it,
Well, see the movie a second time.
I will.
Because I only got that when I saw the movie a second time. I had thoroughly enjoyed it the first time. I was moved to tears by it. And yet when I walked out of the theater, I thought, Wait a minute. What was it about exactly?
It's like you have
to
process it.
Yeah. It gets a visceral reaction from you the first time. It can get a more intellectual reaction from you the second time, so you can explain it better to friends.
Just before we press on, I'm trying to remember the name of the movie that's kind of the kissing cousin of this movie, and I think it's by the same director. What's the title I'm trying to think of here?
Oh, yes.
The Grand
The Great Beauty.
The Great... Yeah. That was another amazing film in a kind of cryptic way. Mm-hmm.
I tell you, though, I saw The Great Beauty for the second time recently on DVD.
Oh.
And it impressed me again for its great beauty.
Yes.
But it did not yield up as clear a theme seeing it the second time around because it's so episodic.
Right.
And it announces itself so clearly in its opening scene that you feel it doesn't have anywhere to go in its subsequent scenes. You get the feeling that the hero, an aging columnist, an aging gossip monger.
Right.
You feel that he has lost all meaning in his life and is just enjoying the sensual beauty of life. Well, you get that in the early scenes, and the movie doesn't go anywhere further with that theme. But youth does.
Yeah.
It really unfolds, and it has scenes that are truly connected with each other and that reach an appropriate climax. It really develops. It grows as it goes along.
You know, we should not forget to mention that great actor who played Brian Wilson. Oh, Dano? Is
Paul,
that his name?
Paul Dano, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Didn't he do a good job?
Yes,
in
he
youth?
Was. Yes, yeah. He's playing a part that's not comfortable for him because he's playing somebody who made it in an action film
and
gained great fame and financial rewards because of an action movie. It's hard to see Paul Dano in an action movie.
It's true.
But as a playing an actor who is contemptuous of the action genre and who's contemptuous of his own youth audience, he was convincing, I felt.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I kind of thought, well, that actor who plays Spider-Man, he doesn't seem like an action guy either.
You're right.
So I thought, well, maybe that's the kind of action figure he played.
There's also Robert Downey, who's had a big success playing Iron Man.
Yeah.
And he's not your typical action star
exactly.
either.
Exactly. So interesting.
So they must have...
The thinking man's action stars.
Yeah, yeah.
This is a visit with Commonweal film critic Richard Oliva talking about this year's batch of movies as we approach next week's Oscar telecast. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM Middletown, providing community radio that matters, and WHUS, 91.7 FM Stores, UConn's radio for the people.
Hi, this is Billy Johnstone, host of the Broadway Radio Hour. Join me every second and fourth Sunday of the month from 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. as I feature the best of Broadway from old classics to last night's curtain, as well as exciting interviews with some of Broadway's brightest stars. The Broadway Radio Hour, right here on WESU Middletown.
The views expressed on this program are the views of the individual broadcaster and do not necessarily reflect the view of Wesleyan University or the WESU management.
If I cried a little bit when first I learned the
shall we get on now? We've let our listeners wait long enough to your Oscar picks.
Okay, I'm just going to announce the ones that I'm sure of, and I'll tell you what I'm unsure of. The Revenant is going to win Best Picture because it has all these pretensions to something artistic, but it's cleaned up at the box office, too. So that's a lock. Best actor, I'm not really sure of, but I think...
Who are our options?
Well, the options, Bryan Cranston for Trumbo, Matt Damon for The Martian. Matt Damon pretty much coasting on his nice personality. Bryan Cranston making Trumbo into kind of a secular saint. Very unconvincing. Leonardo DiCaprio still growing as an actor and doing quite well in The Revenant. Michael Fassbender as Steve Jobs. And Eddie Redmayne as the Danish girl.
Yeah, did you see those last
Yes, I did. I have to say that I think Eddie Redmayne just has a chance of getting his second Oscar in a row. It does happen. Spencer Tracy, Katharine Hepburn.
And you thought the performance was that good?
No, I thought the performance was dreadful, but I think it's going to win as Best Actor.
Why?
I thought it was a one-note performance full of coy little smiles and what the French called moues, little pouts. And then he latched on to two or three expressions and expected that to carry him through the movie. And everybody is wild. Oh, Eddie Redmayne, he looks so convincing as a pretty woman. Actually, he doesn't. He looks very unconvincing as a pretty woman. He looks like a homely man trying to play a beautiful woman.
Like Tootsie.
And he does not open up the character at all. Years ago, and I wish I could remember the title of the week, Vanessa Redgrave, on a television movie, played one of the first American men to have an operation and to become a woman. And she gave a marvelous performance in this movie that I should have looked up but didn't.
Don't worry.
And she was convincing enough as a guy at the beginning of the movie. And when she was transformed into a woman, of course, she had no problem with that at all. And she gave a marvelous performance and really gave you an insight into the psychological shock that man had to suffer when becoming a woman and his subsequent adjustment to his new gender. Yeah. It really let you into the psychology of the process. And it's a process that is so alien to most of us that it was a valuable psychological experience to have an insight like that. I got nothing like that from the Eddie Redmayne.
What did you think of him as Stephen Hawking?
Marvelous. Great performance last year.
Okay.
Yeah. But I think in this movie, he settled for too little, and the director let him settle for too little.
Interesting.
Two or three facial expressions do not carry a movie.
Who was the one before him on the list
here? Michael Fassbender for Steve Jobs. I have to confess, like a lot of other people, I missed it because the studio withdrew the movie.
Why?
It lost money in its first 2 weeks, and it was gone.
Wow.
The documentary, also called Steve Jobs, I think, or maybe just called Jobs, is marvelous.
Huh.
That I could catch. And that, costing much less, made some money at the box office and is now on DVD. Steve Jobs, the fictional film of Michael Fassbender, isn't even yet on DVD, but I will get it when it comes out.
Next.
He is a marvelous actor, though, Michael Fassbender. Supporting actor, I think Sylvester Stallone is going to get Best Supporting Actor for Rocky.
Sort of makes up
for not getting it when he first played Rocky and was nominated.
Yeah.
I think he's never been nominated since.
So that's the real sympathetic.
Yeah, I think it's going to bring him full circle.
Okay.
Supporting actress is a marvelous category because they're all great. And it has all these marvelous young British and American actresses who have popped up in the last 8 or 9 years, and it's just an astounding field.
What names are there?
Well, there's Jennifer Jason Leigh, who's kind of a veteran for The Hateful Eight. Then there's Rooney Mara. I don't know if she's Irish or Irish-American. She's a marvelous actress, and she played the lesbian lover in Carol and gives a marvelous performance there. There's Rachel McAdams, who we talked about in Spotlight, who's the kind of actress you feel she's much too pretty to be a good actress, but she's marvelous in Spotlight.
She really is.
Alicia Vikander in The Danish Girl is the wife of Eddie Redmayne, and she's very good.
Yeah.
Very good. And Kate Winslet in Steve Jobs, which I haven't seen, but these are all marvelous
younger actresses.
I'm going to say Rooney Mara for Carol.
All right.
But she may or may not win. Best actress, Cate Blanchett for Carol, Brie Larson for Room, Jennifer Lawrence for Joy, Charlotte Rampling, one of my favorites for 45 years, and How do you pronounce her name? Charisse Ronan for Brooklyn. I'm sure I've mispronounced it. I think the winner is going to be Brie Larson for Room. In fact, I'm almost convinced she'll get it.
You saw that movie.
Yeah, yeah. Very good film.
Really?
Best director will be, as I said, Iñárritu for The Revenant.
Who's his competition?
Adam McKay for The Big Short. Great job. George Miller for Mad Max. Well, great job if you like Mad Max. I don't.
Lenny. But you're a boy.
Yeah, well.
You're supposed to like it.
Yeah, I'm a male. Yeah, it's a testosterone-driven movie, but maybe my testosterone has less than years. Lenny Abrahamson for Room. He did a marvelous job. And Tom McCarthy, a marvelous job on Spotlight. Just George Miller for Max.
I'm going to say Spotlight.
No, it's going to be Iñárritu for The Revenant. But I know we all know what's going to win best animated feature, and that's Inside Out.
Oh, really?
No matter how good Shaun the Sheep
I
was.
I do love Shaun the Sheep. I laughed like a nut.
Yes, he's a marvelous cartoonist, whoever that is. He did these movies, these wonderful animated shorts about a man and his a mad inventor and his dog that delight kids so much.
I saw that.
Yeah.
It was one of the shorts.
Yes, yeah.
It was very, what do they call it, steampunk.
Yeah,
that was great. Let's talk a little bit more about Spotlight, which we've already unpacked, but in a previous episode, because I read that it's been shown at the Vatican.
Uh-huh. And they liked it.
I don't know. Did you read that?
Yeah, I read that. They liked it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Pope Francis wasn't in the audience, but nonetheless, it was the committee that's charged with sex abuse.
Mm-hmm. Well, what are they going to do? Are they going to say it's all a pack of lies when it's all been documented by the Boston Globe?
Right.
What are they going to do about it?
They really
this?
Do have limited options here. It's just so absurd. Yeah. Do you find anything spiritually redeeming in this batch of films?
Not really.
No.
Lots of good movies there, but nothing concerned with the spiritual life, unless you believe that The Revenant fulfills its pretensions.
Okay.
And I firmly believe it does not. No, the one spiritual movie of the year is Youth.
Is Youth.
Yeah. And one thing the Youth does is to teach you how erratic life is, and how erratic the spiritual life of people is. You can't count on renewal, spiritual renewal, just when you need spiritual renewal. It comes and it goes. We're kind of at the mercy of a mysterious process.
Uh-huh.
And we can't renew the spiritual life
by willing it.
And this is why I feel religious people, in a way, the ones that put themselves in the hands of God, for instance, like Mother Teresa, who confessed, at least in her journals, I don't know if she confessed it to interviewers, that she lost faith at different times. Mm-hmm. And she just put herself in the hands of God and hoped for the best.
Right.
She didn't feel spiritually renewed. She just counted on its coming. She couldn't do it herself. It's like that passage from the Gospel, Lord, I believe.
Help my unbelief.
That's it. I believe, but help my unbelief.
Yeah.
You just have to go through the motions sometimes and count on.
Fake it till you make it.
that's about it. And that's pretty much what happens in Youth.
Yes, interesting. Yeah. You know, in a 60 Minutes piece, Michael Caine said this was his hardest role.
Yeah. And it's his best performance. Best
you think so?
Best performance of his life. And I'm not surprised that he found it his hardest role.
I was wondering. I was a little cynical when I heard that. It's he's just trying to get us to go see the movie.
No, it's for real. It's for real. He really does give himself to this character in a way I haven't seen him do before. I've always liked Michael Caine. I mean, sure.
How did
Alfie, the man who would be king. He's always been tremendous at the top of his game when playing superficial, cockney, wise asses, con men, as right. in The Man Who Would Be King, as in Alfie,
yeah.
Seducers, callow young or middle-aged punks
yeah.
who don't feel deeply. And he's always brought his technical authority as an actor, his timing, which is exquisite,
right.
his sense of comedy, which is tremendous to these parts, and he's always slid by in them, just as a confidence man would.
Yeah.
I mean, he's the actor's confidence man. I don't mean he's phony.
No.
He's a terrific actor.
Right.
But he doesn't have to summon up great wells of emotion. He doesn't have to sink his bucket into great wells of emotion to play these characters.
Yeah.
He can do them off the top of his head, and he's technically accomplished, and he always gets by. But in this movie, you can feel the tricks just wouldn't work, and he must have felt that too. And he just gives himself over completely to the part so that the actor and the role are just indivisible.
What scene are you thinking about when you say
The whole thing, really, whole thing. But especially that scene where he confesses to an interview, and it's a marvelous shot because the director, Sorrentino, sets it up so that Michael Caine's daughter is yeah. behind him, and she has reproached him for being a phony. And as he talks to the interviewer,
because he left the mother
to explore his sexuality yeah. and so forth, and he really may have caused part of the mother's mental breakdown,
yeah.
or at least he feels that it may be so. So he's carrying a burden of guilt there, and his daughter. And the movie is so good about this. It shows that part of the daughter loves him, and part of the daughter's mind despises him. And it's all very, very convincing. But in this one shot, she's behind him. He's not looking at her. She's in the background of the shot.
Yeah.
And as he confesses to an interviewer that he cannot conduct his music anymore because he made the music for his wife, a great soprano. And now that she has broken down and become a mental wreck, he cannot continue to create anymore. He says that verbally, but you know that also he's suffering from this deep guilt that he may have caused the wife's breakdown. And as he confesses to the interviewer, the daughter reads what he's saying perfectly. She knows what he's really confessing, that he may have spiritually murdered his own wife whom he loved. And she, the daughter, in the background of the shot, breaks down just as the father breaks down in speaking to the interviewer. So you see Michael Caine in medium close-up, and you see the daughter behind him in the background also break down at the same time. He can't see what he's doing to his daughter at the same time because he's facing the interviewer. Mm. It's a marvelous shot and a marvelous scene. And you feel Michael Caine is lending himself to the character in a way that's very, very rare on screen. Brando did it a couple of times in maybe On the Waterfront and Last Tango in Paris. And Jack Nicholson maybe once or twice. Robert De Niro once or twice. Michael Caine really has achieved that kind of authenticity in this particular part. And if you don't see this movie, you will spiritually impoverish yourself.
Wow.
I'm saying that to your listeners.
Yeah, no.
Go out and rent the DVD of Youth.
Wow. I will. This is a visit with Commonweal film critic Richard Oliva. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM Middletown, and WHUS, 91.7 FM Stores. In my room. Well, is there anything else you want to talk about, Richard, before we...
I'm not going to watch the Oscars this year.
Come on.
No. You know, and I tell you, it's not for any intellectual reason or anything. It's just that they really, really kind of bore me. And I'm afraid too much of their time this year will be taken up with the matter of their lack of African-American nominees, and that they will make all sorts of self-excusing mea culpas, but mea culpas that really flatter themselves.
Uh-huh. That's interesting.
I mean, I'm sure Chris Rock will get some mileage out of that and more power to him.
Yeah.
But I'm afraid it's just going to be a lot of self-flattery.
You're
going to
watch it.
Nah.
That's my prediction.
I tell you what I'll do. I'll watch the beginning until they come to Best Supporting Actor, which they do in the first half hour. Then I will turn it off, do something else, and turn it back on around midnight
for Best Picture.
That's as far as I will
go. I don't know. We're going to talk afterward and see if you followed that plan.
If they have a production number for the worst song ever written, The Writing on the Wall, for the James Bond movie, I will want to tune in.
What was the James Bond movie?
The James Bond movie is Spectre, and it was a darn good movie.
Really?
With the worst James Bond song ever written. And I will want to see what they do with that as a production number. It's a dreadful song.
Well, you say that the song for Youth was nominated. I don't even remember a song.
The song in Youth.
Oh, is it the simple?
Yeah, the simple song. It's the centerpiece of the movie because it's what
right.
the hero is asked to conduct for Queen Elizabeth in honor of her husband's birthday. Well, let's not give away the ending.
Because that song does
figure in the end of the movie.
All right. I will watch it again and pay attention to that, among other things. So, well, thank you, Richard Oliva, for coming by.
Thank you for having me.
Always a pleasure. What are you going to see next?
I do want to see 45 Years, for which Charlotte Rampling is nominated.
You know, she made some controversial comments about the race thing. Did you read those?
No, I did not. What did she say?
She was really on the side of the Academy, it sounded like, saying, you know what, we can't be thinking about this.
I kind of agree with her, if that's what she said.
Yeah.
A person voting for a particular category cannot think, well, let me give one vote to any African American. They have to vote for what they really feel is the best performance or the best picture. My complaint is, why aren't there more African American movies, and why not more roles, good roles for African American actors? There have been in the past, and African American actors have won. But this year, there was just a dearth of such roles. That's what the problem is.
And apparently the blame, last year.
Yeah.
Because isn't this the second year in a row?
Yeah. But the blame has to be laid at the door of the people who give the green lights for expensive movies.
Yeah. You and I should write a script.
About what?
I don't know.
Catholic Americans.
Yeah, black Catholics. I don't know. What are you giving up for Lent? Or doing for Lent?
This would be a convenient time to give up movies. Because there aren't any good ones at this time of year.
Let me... we have a minute or two. I just want to confess something that's perhaps a little politically incorrect. Mm-hmm. And you can scold me or agree with me. And that is regarding Carol.
Mm.
I avoided it because I felt, you know what? I know this story.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Two women are going to fall in love. They're going to face some obstacles involving society at the time. I think it's the 50s.
Yes.
It's going to reach some horrible climax where something is going to be revealed that's terrible and uncomfortable, and then it's going to resolve in a happy way.
Mm-hmm.
I just felt like early, I don't know, is it me? Am I giving it short shrift?
Well, you predicted it pretty well. So in a sense, I have to agree with you, and in a sense, I can't encourage you to see it. Yet, it is a fairly good movie. And it's a fairly good movie precisely because it captures that era in American history very, very well, the late 40s and the 1950s, in which it was practically speaking, it was a criminal act to be any sort of sexual invert, to be homosexual in any way. And, of course, they do meet that obstacle, and the obstacle – in a way, is overcome. I won't give away too much.
Okay.
But the strength of the movie is in capturing that era. And the story plays itself out pretty convincingly with two marvelous performances and superb photography and superb scenic design, which gets the period perfectly. The production designer really deserves
the Oscar.
Is it
like Mad Men?
Oh, it's even better than Mad Men for capturing that period, and less self-conscious and less self-righteous than Mad Men. Mad Men is, look at the 50s. Oh, these poor people. How we've outgrown it. We're so enlightened. Those 50s people, what spiritual pygmies they are. Carol does not go in for that. It says, look, here's the period. And this is how these women had to exist in that social climate. And it's completely convincing on that score. And the actresses are quite, quite marvelous. The limitation of the movie is that it does not delve into what is even more, much more interesting than the plight of two lesbian women, the plight of their sexuality. What's really interesting is when they are brought together by their sexual interest, they're of two different classes. The older woman is upper middle class. The younger woman is a striver. She's lower middle class from the Midwest, striving to achieve some recognition in a field dominated by men. She's some sort of, not a copywriter, but she's working in the journalistic sphere. And, of course, she's not used to the good things in life, while her lover is completely at ease in an upper class environment. She knows how to dress perfectly. She knows how to talk smoothly. Mm. She knows how to order from a menu perfectly. Yeah. She knows how to treat waiters. She knows this. She knows that.
Now, that is interesting.
That is the interesting part of the movie. And if only the movie delved into that further and showed that the tension between the two women might not just be a matter of, will anybody discover that we're lesbian lovers, but rather, how am I going to get along with this woman from a different class who knows so much more than I do, who can educate me in the upper class ways of the world, but also makes me feel rather inferior and scuzzy compared to her? It could be, a heterosexual relationship would do that too.
Right, right.
But it would be really interesting to see this in a lesbian relationship, because here's a girl trying to learn from a beautiful upper-class woman, and yet at the same time has to be careful not to announce to the rest of the world that this teacher of mine is also my lover.
But the
movie doesn't get very far with the class element, and I wish it did.
You know, since we're talking then, I'll tell you also why I've avoided Room.
Uh-huh.
It sounds like I haven't seen a single one of these movies, and it's pretty close to true. But I don't know, I'm getting a little tender, I think, in my old age. Uh-huh. I just don't want to watch a child who's been so abused. It's just, wow. That's...
Yeah, but remember, it's not the child who's abused. The child is happy throughout the movie.
Really?
Trapped in a room. The room is his world, and he is happy in his world. The abused one is his mother, who's trapped by her rapist in a room and is dying of both boredom and terror, like a soldier caught up in a war. But what soldiers always complain about is the boredom and the terror of war. 95% boredom, 5% terror.
Yeah.
And that is what this woman goes through, 95% mind-crushing boredom, trapped in one room, you know, 30 feet by 10 feet. It's like, you know, it's no bigger than a trailer. And 5% terror when he comes in once a month to rape her. So for her, it's terror.
Yeah, I'm not going to see
this
movie.
At the same time, it's worth seeing, because it's interesting to see the way she shields her son from terror and tries to make his life as happy as possible. But as she does this, as she makes her son's life happy, she has to lie to him and say that there is no world outside room, which is the universe.
Wow.
So, but what happens when they get a chance to escape? that she has to stop lying to him. And that's what makes the movie really, really worthwhile.
Oh, now you're talking me into it. See?
Yeah, go, don't be such a chicken. Don't be a sissy. I don't blame you when it comes to The Revenant. Who wants to see a bear tear a man to pieces?
You know?
And who wants to see a horse disemboweled so you can crawl inside the horse? Well, I don't mind it. And The Revenant has its rewards. So I'm willing to put up with its flaws.
Well, you say you're getting tougher.
Yeah, I'm getting more calloused is what I mean to say. I'm not getting tougher. I'm just getting more and more calloused and amoral as I watch more and more calloused and amoral movies. You know, but don't be a sissy about Room.
Really?
Yeah. Go to see it.
Thanks again.
Okay.
That was an interview with Commonweal film critic Richard Oliva. That's all for this episode. If you missed any of Richard's Oscar wisdom or want to check out any previous shows, you can find the audio archived online at reasonablycatholic.com. Thanks for listening. See you in 2 weeks. I'm Maria Johnson. Stay tuned for The Jive at 5 and Brass and Sass with DJ Thrasher.